Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 103 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and David Vanderhoof returns after a week off. Hi, David.
Hi, Max.
Did you enjoy the little break in the excitement?
Yeah, I was, as I was lounging around the pool, having a glass of wine and having some filet mignon, I was really concerned that you guys were not able to pull this off without me, and clearly you guys can't pull it off without me.
Yeah, you listened to our military stories last week, huh?
Yeah.
All right, also joining us, of course, is Rob Mark. Hi, Rob.
Hey, hi from Chicago. And I have to tell you, I'm really glad David's back, because if he sent us any more of those pictures of him in that little thong bikini, I was really going to lose my lunch. So better that he's here where we can keep an eye on him.
Funny man.
Also joining us, of course, is Dan Webb. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Still trying to get that image out of my head right now, so really don't have a whole lot of words to say.
I think we should leave it
at that. Good to be here, I guess. Yeah.
All right. Well, our guest today is Dave Pasco. He's from the liveatc.net site. Hey, Dave.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Very good. Live ATC, I've been listening to some of that lately, and it's pretty enjoyable. How many airports do you have on there?
We have over 400 streams, which probably is somewhere, we're in the 300s in terms of airports.
Great. Yeah, looking forward to talking to you about that site in more detail.
So you're part of the reason our internet feed is slow then, right?
It's all these live feeds.
It's all my fault. I'm still trying, still trying to unsee that bathing suit image.
Yeah.
Jeez, and he's never even met me before. God.
All right, well, coming up, we're going to have David's This Week in Aviation and also the Australia Desk report from Steve and Grant. You're going to enjoy this one, too. The guys are still continuing their journey back home after the Airplane Geeks 100th party. First, though, we've got some aviation news from the past week. Everybody all set for that?
Mm-hmm.
Our first story comes from the Associated Press. This is United and Continental pilots say talks falter. Pilots for United and Continental Airlines say that they've hit a roadblock in their negotiations with the two companies. According to this article, the talks have broken off after, I guess, just one meeting, and they don't have any plans for any additional talks at this time. In terms of what's going on, we don't know too much, but the union says that the disagreement was over something that had little financial impact. Rob, any ideas what's going on with these guys?
Seniority? That's usually the thing that tends to make crews the most upset. I just think it's kind of interesting, though, that they say that it has very little financial... Dan, doesn't everything have a financial edge to it in these cases?
Yeah, but I feel like an issue like seniority has less of a financial impact than, say, scope.
Mm-hmm, maybe. It's pretty contentious, though. Look at U.S. Air.
They've Well, at least for U.S. Airways, they're not paying any of the legal fees involved in that one. But I feel that everything has financial impact, but seniority has less of an impact for the company than it does for. I'm not sure if they mean financial impact for the company, because obviously seniority has a nice financial impact for your individual paycheck.
Yeah, sure.
Sure, and of course, everybody on the Hill has been saying this is probably going to be a done deal, so I can't imagine that anyone in Chicago or Houston is going to be real excited to hear about a fly in the ointment, although coming from the pilots, I'm sure they're saying, we wondered when this was going to appear, because that's usually what happens.
There's no real imminent pressure on any of the parties involved in this, right? I mean, all they're looking to do is get this deal put together by the end of the year. So it's kind of early in the process, isn't it? I mean, there's still a lot of positioning and a lot of dancing around and a lot of negotiating that's yet to come, I would imagine.
That's definitely true, but also, actually, they didn't have the date on it, but United had and Continental had a filing out this week. An SEC filing just setting up. It didn't list the date yet, but obviously you're going to have big shareholder meetings on either side on voting on the merger. And I'm sure, well, I'm not sure how much opposition there is some opposition on the Continental side with the pricing of the deal.
Mm-hmm.
naturally, if I'm a shareholder in Continental, which I think still is the stronger stronger financially right now, I don't want to vote for a merger if labor strife already seems to be on the horizon.
Sure.
So, I mean, we're still early in the process, but I still think that this should, you know, they should try to push this for the end of the year, like you said, because this is why Delta Northwest has been hailed as a success, is because that pilots agreement was hammered out very quickly. Whereas if you look at some other mergers, specifically U.S. Airways, right, where they're still fighting, and of course, I mean, if you look at American and TWA, that didn't turn out too well for TWA labor, though. I think that's a different situation. While I think the main difference is, I think when American bought TWA, TWA was in much worse shape than American, and a lot of that capacity ended up getting cut. Whereas I think, we'll see with United and Continental. But anyway, those are my two cents.
Who's got the better contract, United or Continental?
Ooh, I really haven't looked at that. I'm not sure. I really haven't checked for pay.
Continental's paid. Their pilots are paid better than United pilots are.
Yeah, okay. I'm not sure about general work rules and stuff, but for the pilots, Continental has a much better scope clause than United from a pilot perspective. That's why for Continental, they're capped with the number of 50-seat RJs they can have, and that's why the only 70-seat aircraft that Continental has, of course, there are good reasons for choosing this aircraft, but that's why the only 70-seater they have is the Q400. I believe that scope clause prevents them from getting any 70-seat jets, whereas United, there are caps as well, like a lot of other scope clauses. As everyone knows, United, heavy user of CRJ-700s, E-170 jets. So I'd say Continental, I'm not sure what Rob thinks, I'd say Continental might have the better contract, but obviously I'd need to see the actual contract to decide that, but that's my feeling.
Well, there's certainly less labor strife at Continental than there is at United. I mean, so again, whether that's a great contract or not, I don't know. But I mean, it's certainly something to be considered in the mix.
Yeah, I also want to think that I'm not sure. This is where I wish we had Lewis on. We were talking about this last week. I want to say that Continental has less pilots on furlough than United, but I'm not positive on that.
Well, this seems like something that we're definitely going to have to watch as it develops. Speaking of watching, our next story comes from Spiffy News. This is a sexy Spirit Airlines ad that mocks BP oil disaster sparks outrage. Well, Spirit Airlines started a promotion. It didn't last very long, I guess, but a promotion on their website that featured images of women in bikinis that were kind of covered in oil with the tagline, "Check out the oil on our beaches." The point
works
was,
for me.
I think the point was that they were trying to make was that that there are still destination spots that Spirit Airlines, of course, would more than happy to take you to. They are still pristine and unaffected by the oil spewing into the Gulf. But not everybody thought this was a great idea.
Yeah, well, I think Brett Snyder had the best post on this. And I fell into the trap too, especially after there was a news release clarifying that, oh, by the way,
Had to be a press release based on the commercial coming from a marketing standpoint is a failure.
Yeah. Oh, well, the other thing I noticed is that on the sunscreen bottles on the promotion, those were labeled best protection.
As in
green.
Yes. Well, in yellow. Yes. Well, the bottles were green, letters were yellow. But I kind of fell into the trap about writing about it once we got the press release going. Spirit responds to inquiries on today's beach promotion. It is unfortunate that some have misunderstood our intention with today's beach promotion. We are merely addressing the false perception that we have oil on our beaches, blah, 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 blah. But Brett Snyder had a very smart post on this. He says, the media is falling right into Spirit's trap. They like making advertising campaigns that maybe a little push the envelope a little bit, and people write about it, and it's free advertising. And it seems to have worked for – I mean, look at what Brian Hare does. They have some shocking stuff every now and then as well.
Exactly.
And everyone writes about how, okay, we hate Ryanair, but it gets the Ryanair name or the Spirit name out there. I mean, I guess their strategy is there is no such thing as bad PR. And I mean, this is what Spirit always does.
Sure.
I mean,
they've had some great ones.
They had the Eye of the Tiger sale a few months ago with a tiger crashing an SUV on the homepage. My favorite was the, this is not appropriate for the podcast, the Many Islands Low Fares sale. That one was my favorite still. Most inappropriate one. No one else laughing at that one? No?
I didn't see it.
I don't recall that one, yeah.
But just put together the acronym. Okay, never mind.
Okay.
More island. What was it again?
Many Islands Low Fares.
Many Islands Low Fares. Ah, yes. Okay, right. Gotcha. So does anybody have a link to this alleged spirit debacle that they can send me? Because I didn't get to see it.
I think it's gone, though. I think it was just up for about a day or so.
Let's be serious. You know that old story about any kind of PR is... What was it that you said before? There's no such thing as bad PR? No,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Tell that to BP. I mean...
Well, yeah.
That's very true.
There's some exceptions.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, our next item comes from DNA India. This is ATC's crisis night. Backup does not work as radar fails. Now, this is a story about some problems at the Mumbai airport. According to this article, power cuts at the air traffic control are becoming more frequent there. They had a problem with a sudden blackout, which took out the tower, paralyzed the radar. They have a backup system, but the VHF radio stopped working. And, at that time, there were four arrivals and 15 departures lined up. Certainly when the air traffic control system goes out, that's not a great thing. Dave, is this something that happens very often? Aren't air traffic control systems usually kind of, built on redundant systems?
Yeah, I mean, certainly here in the U.S. and I know in Canada and many other places, they're really built on pretty reliable technology and there's redundancy. And a big part of the issue here, I think, with Mumbai is, in general, I mean, and I don't mean this, in an absolute sense, but in a relative sense, if you compare India with other countries, there are certainly places with less reliable power grids, for example. But particularly in India, if you want to compare it with our power grid, I mean, there's absolutely no real comparison. And I do know a bit about that. So it does happen. It appears they had some redundant systems. But whenever you have a system that is this critical,
right,
you have to ask yourself procedurally, do they test their backups? Do they prepare for this or they just hope the backups work? I mean, obviously, I don't know all the nitty gritty details. There's a story behind every story. But
yeah, sure.
Here it's not a very frequent occasion in the U.S. It's big news when it does happen. Once a year, maybe twice a year, I'd say the last few years, I think we've heard a handful of stories. But, the system is really built to sort of work around it. If you look at IFR separation of aircraft, it's really built so that it can tolerate, the whole system is built to tolerate a communication failure.
Now, I mean, there used to be a time when those kinds of failures were fairly common, though. Of course, I grant you that's a few years ago, but unless you've been in a place like that, when the power dies, it just all hell breaks loose in there because you just suddenly know that there are all those airplanes out there that you can't see. But of course, they also used to have paper strips as a backup for what was on the screen electronically. And now that doesn't even really – well, no, I shouldn't say that. In the center, I think in approach control, it does still exist, but it's, again, the redundancy is so good here. But, Dave, I was going to ask you, is Mumbai one of the towers in your list? Do you guys listen in on them?
No, we're working on some coverage in India, but we're not quite there yet.
This is probably slowing it down, right?
If the feed goes dark, it's not very useful, right?
Well, are there any legal issues in India? Because weren't those spotters there arrested? What wasn't one of the reasons didn't they have scanners, I think?
Yeah, I mean, the legal issue, of course, does come up in many different places, and it's one of the impediments to our progress in the UK. We used to have a bunch of UK feeds, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. But it's certainly an impediment in some cases. We're not subject to those laws, but obviously the people who would assist or provide the actual stream to Live ATC would actually be potentially at risk, and they'd certainly be violating the law if it's actually spelled out. Most of the time, what it is really an antiquated law that was created at a time when communications privacy was, they attempted to legislate it. So instead of encrypting communications and and sort of, you know, protecting the communications themselves, which is more costly and complicated, they just created laws to disallow people to even listen, let alone stream. So another thing I was going to say about the reliability thing, though, was what's interesting, beyond our redundant systems here in the U.S., there's some amazing use of ingenuity with cell phones and things like that. And I'm not sure if it's formal where facilities know that there's a working cell phone in another facility that's used in an emergency and that sort of thing. But there have been cases where phones have been, you know, basically picked up and they started doing all this coordination over cell phones. So.
Well, didn't they? Didn't the controller get into trouble for doing that? Wasn't that in the news sometime recently?
I missed that, and I'm not sure if it's the case I was thinking of. I don't recall which one it was, but, you know, it's kind of unbelievable. You know, it's sort of unimaginable that any real trouble could really come from that when somebody's trying to save lives and you know, do the right
absolutely.
Thing.
Yeah.
But you could easily see how it might happen.
I recall some kind of a story where the controller, you know, did use his cell phone, or maybe the pilot did.
I think it was a pilot, and that was actually a pilot story.
Ah, maybe that's it, right.
And that was the pilot. Wasn't that the pilot who was texting, like, on short final or something?
Oh, that's different, I think.
That was a different story.
Yeah, yeah. But okay, well, we can move on to the next story, which is actually another ATC story. This is from avstop.com. FAA to change age retirement rules for air traffic controllers. So the FAA has proposed an amendment to its regulations that would require air traffic controllers to retire at age 56. Under the current policy, air traffic controllers must be 18 years of age. The maximum age one can start training is 30, which I think is kind of interesting, and they must retire at 56. Now, there's some exceptions made for those coming out of the military where they can join up to age 31. So age 56, that sounds awfully young to retire. I don't know, is there some kind of data or some kind of incidents behind this that's causing the view?
Probably not. I mean, FAA's had that in force for many, many, many years. There have been some situations in which controllers have stayed to age 61 with some what's the word I'm struggling for? A waiver.
Yeah, a waiver.
And that's what this whole story is really about, is that they're having trouble producing the waiver paperwork the way that they used to, and they've just decided it's not worth the paperwork anymore because it asked for some things that related to privacy, and so it's kind of fallen apart. But it's interesting. I don't know how many I tried to get a hold of Doug Church over at NATCA. I can't say it, but I can say it at NATCA to find out some info about this, but I couldn't get a hold of him because I was curious how many people have actually filed for this this waiver. Because remember, it was just a few years ago when the Bush administration was still in the White House that controllers were bailing out left and right. No one needed to worry about anybody getting a waiver to stay to 61. Nobody wanted to stay. They didn't even want to stay to 56.
Yeah.
So you had people retiring with 20 years of service. You know, if you started at age 20, or 22, 25, you could retire at age 50 with 25 years of service. So, I mean, and while that is a relatively young age in terms of the rest of us,
sure.
No comments, Dan. I could see his little light lighting up there. He's ready to zing me. I mean, that job makes you a little nutty. And so I think that most of the controllers that I've known, ones I used to work with too, I'd say, by 56, they didn't even want to stay. So, I don't know how big a deal this really is in terms of them having this waiver or not.
Hmm. Hey, guys, guess what?
What?
Rob's old.
Yeah, somebody else put that on the Facebook page. Did you see that? Or was it in one of our listener mails? Somebody said
that
sounds pretty good for 90 or something like that.
Yeah. Well, what is it that really drives how long a controller is effective in the job? It's not age.
No, I think it's reflexes. I mean, that's just me. I mean, I think you can find people that work in. I have a friend of mine that just retired from O'Hare from the Tracon about a year ago, and I won't mention his name because who knows? Some of his friends may be listening. But he was good right up to the moment that he left. And I'm telling you, the one nice thing about that is that keeps your brain juice going so well that it's hard to imagine slowing down once you quit. But then there are people that early on in their career just were barely able to keep up. And so by the time they hit 25 years, I mean, they were just an accident looking for a place to happen. And so for those people, they were just glad to get out.
I think a lot of it really has to do with aptitude. I know a lot of air traffic controllers. I have a good friend who's been, you know, for the last few years perpetually ready to retire, and he's just involved in so many other activities, and he's just so good at what he does. But I was talking to another controller at an in-route facility recently at a pilot meeting about a couple weeks ago, and I'm always wondering, you know, sort of what causes a new trainee coming in, you know, there's all these young controllers coming in, to actually wash out. And it was really simple. It actually had to do with, you can either get, you know, they call it get the picture,
right?
Or you can't. You can either visualize aircraft in three dimensions and visualize where they're going to be at a certain point in time. To, you know, obviously aircraft separation being the most important thing an air traffic controller does. Or you can't. And if you can never get that picture, it's hard to train people to get that picture. So if you're really good at that, all the other stuff, you know, procedures, frequencies, you know, all the other things, all the rules, those are things that are incredibly teachable through repetition and training. But it's this getting this picture. And so if you extend that to this story and think about, well, you know, for the most part, on average, people's neurons don't fire as fast as they do when you're younger. And it's certainly, there's probably a lot of medical evidence about that. But is everybody really that way? You know, and how much of that does it take for you to not be able to do the job? It's also facility dependent. I mean, if you're, you know, out in the middle of a place that's really pretty low traffic, and that's what you're certified for. Hmm. Nobody's asking for that controller to be relocated to the New York metro area where the traffic's probably 10 to 20X where he is now or she is. So I don't know. I think there's some other variables in here that need to be accounted for. But, of course, it's hard to codify those into rules.
But that's an interesting point. And, you know, I was listening to liveatc.net earlier today, and I was sort of zipping around a few airports, and that's something actually that jumped out pretty strongly in terms of, you know, the volume of activity. You know, listening to Chicago, as you might imagine, was pretty active. Mm-hmm. When I switched over to Bradley, it was a completely different kind of a pace. Now,
Because your airport sucks.
and I'm sure, you know, it varies during the course of the day. I'm sure that there times where Bradley is, you know, extremely busy also, but it really was it had a completely different kind of a feel to it.
Well, and remember too, when we had Bob Poole on a couple of weeks ago, I mean, he kind of made the same point that Dave did. I think he said it a little differently, but that the, you know, FAA doesn't necessarily look at someone and say, well, let's see, Max, we think on a 1 to 10 scale, you're about an 8. And we tend to send our 8s to these kinds of airports.
Yeah.
And if you were a 9, you'd be going to that one. They just grab everybody and throw them anywhere. And so I think facility dependent is a very interesting turn of phrase, but it's very, very accurate because that's exactly what happens. And that's one of the reasons they lose so many people is that good people, people that would be good in some not too busy VFR towers,
right?
End up at, you know, the New York Common IFR room or Atlanta Tower or O'Hare or something, and they don't have the capability to do that.
Interesting. Yeah. So you're talking about, you're right, matching not the aptitude, but matching the abilities of the controllers to the different locations.
Well, yeah, and it's funny because a couple of days after we had Bob Poole on, I ran into Hank Krakowski, who's the chief executive officer of the air traffic organization for FAA. And I hit him with this question specifically, and he said that it was a horrible embarrassment to the agency that this had been going on for as long as it had been and that they were trying to rectify it. So I guess that's good news for the controllers coming in.
Okay, great. Next story comes from Air Transport World. Boeing is going to bring the 787 to Farnborough. This should be flight test aircraft ZA-003. So that's going to be an exciting moment, I think, at Farnborough this summer.
Yeah, too bad flight isn't sending me there. Not that I'm...
Oh, the intern's not going?
No, the intern is not going.
I see.
No, the intern has to stay in purgatory with the person he broke the airplane of, correct,
Dan? That's
right. Well, that was always planned. I mean, that was planned pre-model. By the way, I'm ordering the new wings tomorrow. So
didn't you say that 2 weeks ago?
There is a bit of confusion with the exact wings because this is a 747-8 model that was produced before Boeing decided to stretch the fuselage. So we just had to make sure the right set was being ordered. But no, at least I get to go to Oshkosh. So, I mean, come on. I mean, which is good. I mean, now that I'm, you know, Rob's personal slave, so.
All right. Well, back to the story. 787's a Farnborough, and 787's a Farnborough with cracked and gaps in their tailplanes.
Yeah, that was poor announcement timing, accidentally.
So, Dan, tell us about what Boeing has discovered.
I want David to do that. I got to read the article.
You're not going to cut that part out, are you, Max? Where
no, it's staying in.
He doesn't know what's going on. Okay.
Well,
friend of the podcast, John Ostrower, wrote in Flight Global.
Green jacket friend of the podcast.
A green jacket friend, absolutely. Boeing has imposed a temporary operating limitation on all five of its 787 test aircraft, and these are structural gaps that were discovered in the horizontal stabilizer. So I think this is a problem with a supplier part.
Elena in Italy is supplying the parts and shipping them over to Seattle.
According to John, he says that there are gaps that shims are intended to fit in, and they were found to be deficient. And this is going to require that they take a look at this and take some corrective action. It doesn't sound like Boeing is too terribly upset about this, but it is, it is another setback.
Yeah, and their PR people were very, they basically put out a press release saying, no, this is not a grounding of the fleet. So, because obviously that word has a much stronger negative connotation, but
sure,
it doesn't seem like I'm not, was it last year or year or the year before? I already forget when they required, oh, by the way, we need to do that wing body fix. So,
well, hopefully Boeing will get this corrected quickly and move on.
Hopefully ANA can fly off with their with the first frame for them later this year.
But it does harp back to their supply chain problem where the 787 was a global product.
Right.
And all of these parts were coming around from the world. And we're back to supply chains on their subcontractors overseas where they can't keep an eye on their subcontractors.
Well, this is why when I graduate with a degree in 2 years, God willing, I will write, "Dear Boeing, guess what? I have a minor in supply chain. Hire me. Love and hugs, Dan."
I think they'll get it right. I think that others will end up, using the same strategy or similar strategies. Okay, we have another article from Flight Global. This is U.S. Air Force and industry prepare for a T-38 replacement. So the Air Force may be launching a contest to replace the Northrop T-38 Talon. That's the trainer that was introduced way back in 1962, David, right?
It's long in the tooth, though a fantastic aircraft. Though I do want our listeners to note that the military geek of the podcast could talk intelligently about 787s, unlike the rest of the crew for last week. But back to T-38s.
Oh.
T-38s are long in the tooth. They're 1962, the aircraft that they were designed to train people for are long gone. Phantoms, F-100s, Dan?
Well, I just think, just to give a more inaccurate image of how old the aircraft is, it's approximately 0.78 ROBs.
So. I knew this was coming. I knew it was coming. Oh, you are so washing. You are so washing dishes at Airbench. I'm telling you.
I'm sorry. I just wanted to do the math.
Harsh.
The T-38s are one of those aircraft like B-52s, and that vintage of aircraft that the only thing that can replace a T-38 seems to be another T-38. They re-engined them recently. They're now called T-38Cs. They have better turbofan engines instead of the turbojets. But we desperately need a jet trainer. We have the T-6A Texan 2s. God, why we named them that, I'll never know. But which are actually Pilatus PC-9s. And the guys down under would know that what a PC9 is, because it seems like every the world uses them as primary trainers.
Yeah.
But we need lead and jet trainers. And it's kind of hard to go from a PC9 to an F-22. And somehow you got to get somebody supersonic training. So we desperately need a trainer. And this is the biggest contract that no one's talking about. I mean, 450 aircraft plus whatever global sales they'll be, and it's quietly under the radar while we end up talking about tankers every week, and this is probably even more importantly.
So who's going to bid on – who do you think is going to bid on this thing, David?
Well, according to the article, Lockheed Martin, but Lockheed Martin isn't even using their own product. Lockheed Martin is using a T-50, which is actually General Dynamics and Samsung of Korea built the T-50 Golden Eagle, which is a lead-in fighter trainer, and it's a foreign product that General Dynamics was with. It was designed to teach Koreans how to fly F-16s, so it does have some commonality with the F-16. That's what they're proposing, and I'm sure Boeing will come along. And Aramaki, the Italian company, has the M-346, which is kind of ironic because that's a Russian design. That was originally a Yakovlev design.
Well, just the reason I ask is, let's say Boeing bids on this, and they could be like, hey, Defense Department, we got this T-38s, we'll toss in some tankers half off if you go with us.
You know, that's the interesting about government purchasing departments. They don't talk to each other. So while the tanker programs are being run one way, you'll probably see the trainer program run really well, because the acquisition of the PC-9, which became the T-6A, went very smoothly. Likewise, they talk in this about T-45s, which is actually a British Aerospace Hawk modified for the Navy. They got side arrestor hooks. It got reinforced landing gear. That's kind of what Boeing would want to submit, but the British Hawk is getting as long in the tooth as the T-38 is, even though a lot of the world uses it as their jet trainers, and some of them use it for primary attack aircraft. But if you want a next generation trainer, they're going to have to come out with a clean paper design. And I don't think the T-50 is that. It's sort of a half and half kind of thing. So somebody should come out with a clean paper design, and they'll make lots of money for a very long time.
Mm. Yeah. According
to this, I was talking about the tanker thing, by the way, but continue.
Well, according to this article, that, you know, the full up quantity grows to something like 1,000 aircraft. So this is, this would be an enormous win for somebody. And so it'll be hotly contested, I would imagine.
God, I hope not.
You just want to see it simple, right?
Keep it simple. Build them, fly them, whatever the best aircraft is, buy it.
Oh, if it was only that easy.
I know.
By the way, David, actually, I developed a bit of a interest in defense this week, as you saw via Twitter. So let's give some credit where it's due.
Well, I did. I did say hell was freezing over.
This is true.
And ironically, there was a lot of people who agreed with me.
Well, the hell is freezing over?
Well, Dan was tweeting about military aircraft.
Yes.
Believe it or not.
Yes, because my wonderful boss, Stephen Trimble, who I hope is listening right now. Hey. he basically took me around for some Boeing briefings, so it was fun.
That's good. Rounding out your perspective.
Yes. Yes.
Well, we can round it out a little bit more and talk some GA. And we have an article from AOPA Online, maybe a press release, actually. This is comment extension grants time to act on AVGAS. The EPA has granted an extension, a 60-day extension to the comment period. This is on the ANPR, what you call it, the Advanced Notice of Proposed Rulemaking. On concerning lead emissions from piston aircraft gasoline. So this is low lead 100. Is that right, Rob?
Well, the eventual goal is to get rid of all leaded fuel. Period. And I think it's going to be interesting in this comment. The joke is that these are going to be some of the shortest comments in history that they're going to be reviewing, because they're going to say things like, "We need to get rid of leaded gas," and "After the leaded gas came to be, all our problems were solved," and things like that. And except no one has been able to make any kind of lead-free fuel that can produce the octane to make airplane engines run. And I mean, Cirrus just brought out a new turbo charged airplane not long ago, and they say it will fly on unleaded fuel. And but of course, what they do tell you also is that the aircraft engine numbers will change because they do not believe the engine will perform the way it was designed on unleaded fuel.
Mm-hmm.
I think another big concern for everyone is that the range of fuels that the range of engines that a lead-free fuel might need to serve is vast. I mean, everything from a 100 horsepower 0200 Continental that's in a Cessna 150 up through, you know, again, you know, a 310, 315 horsepower engine in the Cirrus. And you know, the compression ratios are very different. And then someone else threw a monkey wrench in and said, well, maybe we just need two fuels, one to sort of serve the low end and one to serve the high end, which would be even a worse nightmare than what they have right now with unleaded fuels, because I don't think they believe any of the fuel companies would want to build. And again, which one do they produce? You know, because they're actually in it not to serve us, but to actually make some money. And so I think this is going to be no small problem here.
Now, let me play devil's advocate a little bit, because Rob, you and I remember back in the old days when the same issue came up with regard to automotive gasoline. And, you know, there was a hue and cry from the auto manufacturers about switching to no lead gasoline, and from enthusiasts with old cars. And isn't this the same thing, just kind of repeated with airplanes?
To some degree, it is. The one variable that you throw into operation of an airplane engine that you don't have with a car is, while there is certainly the variance in horsepower, there's the altitude and the air mixture changes, constant air mixture changes that are involved. And I'm not an engineer. I don't even claim to be one. I can't even talk about half the stuff that David does. But it apparently is a much bigger problem. Well, either it's a much bigger problem than anyone is letting on, or they have not really focused enough resources on it at this point, because everyone was kind of pushing it to the back burner. And I'm not certain at this point which one that is. All I know is that the clock is now ticking seriously.
What's this thing about gas with lead in it for cars? When was that?
That was way before you were born.
That was right after they took the lead out of the horse feed that we all knew when we were kids.
That's right.
They used to feed horses and stuff. That was before we had cars, Dan. So,
you know, and they also used to paint airplanes with lead paint, Dan.
Another way to look at this, though, I think, Rob, is that if you look at aviation gasoline usage as a percentage of all petroleum fuel usage in the country, say, aviation is just a tiny, tiny fraction of a percent. So,
absolutely, absolutely, and of course, within that framework, jet fuel is by far the more predominant fuel. I mean, it's what the airlines use. It's what business aviation, business jets use, and turboprops and unleaded fuel for propeller-driven piston airplanes is a tiny, tiny, tiny little chunk. And so that's really, really the other problem, is that companies are saying, why do we need to do this?
Right.
Because it's going to cost us a lot more money, and we're not going to make anything on it anyway.
So again, we're speaking with Dave Pascoe. He's the what would you say, the operator, the creator, the man behind all of the above?
Yeah, I'm the founder and the operator.
And that's liveatc.net.
Correct.
What kind of folks listen to Live ATC? How do you characterize the folks who sit around listening to that?
It's all over the map, Max. It's just kind of really amazing, and was probably one of the most surprising things over the last 7 years of, you know, kind of developing it and growing it. It's ranges from pilots to air traffic controllers to just people who have a love for aviation, plane spotters, people who are flight sim hobbyists, nervous flyers. I mean, that's an interesting one.
Oh, really?
Huh. It had cause to, you know, interact with a lot of the community and the audience or over, you know, at different points in time, whether it be, you know, they write in for, you know, with a question or a support issue or what have you. And you sort of, you know, develop a little bit of a conversation with them. And I always sort of ask, you know, how'd you find out about Live ATC? And
yeah,
the nervous flyer case is kind of interesting. People like to listen because they somehow get the soothing feeling. You know, they listen in. They hear all this stuff happening, and they don't understand a lot of it at first, like most of us didn't. I'm a private pilot, by the way, instrument rating, and so I've flown in the system for the last 10 years or so, and so I knew a little bit about aviation communications prior, and I listened a bit when I was a kid, but, you know, obviously learned a lot more in incredible depth over the last 10 years. So, but even though they don't know anything, they hear that it's an orderly thing, everything sounds under control, and you know, it's like a machine that comforts them when they go flying. You know, they just, because they're sitting there, unless they're on United and actually tuned into Channel 9. I'm not sure how many people these days even know about that, but, you know, they're sitting there not knowing what's going on, and some of them are scared. So they still fly, but there's, you know,
right.
I think this puts them a little bit more at ease.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, do you have any tips for, let's just say, the, you know, the average aviation enthusiast, or anyone really who's not a pilot? Any tips for how to kind of learn the lingo and get a better understanding? I mean, I imagine you could sort of figure it out over time, but is there a way to kind of jumpstart your understanding of what's going on when you're listening to live air traffic control?
Sure. I mean, there's a whole bunch of resources out there. People can Google air traffic control and air traffic control positions, you know, tower, ground, approach control. Just if they Google a few of those things, they'll be able to pull up articles. There's tons of, you know, Wikipedia articles and things that describe what each position does. And of course, on Live ATC, we describe what each position is, or at least label them. We'll have a lot more of that educational stuff on there, so to help people out. It just hasn't been a focus item.
It's pretty easy to use. I mean, you can just put in the you know, the airport code, and I see, you know, you have a choice. You can listen to it either in your browser with Flash or in your browser with Java, or you can have it launch your MP3 player. So it's I mean, you have a lot of options, and it's actually pretty easy to use.
Yeah, it's pretty easy with the advent of, you know, more usable mobile platforms than some of the smartphones and things we had in the early days. There is a mobile version of it, which is, you know, kind of in beta, but really it works pretty well. It's M, like Mary, M as in Mary, .liveatc.net. So somebody with a Palm or, you know, a BlackBerry or an Android device can just sort of tune into that URL. The issue with the mobile platforms is, you know, we have an iPhone application, which makes it really trivial. People don't have to really use a web browser. They just use the app. And everything right now in the mobile world is kind of really app-driven. But
right.
There's going to be a huge push, I think, for getting back to what we call the mobile web. And so, you know, this is the beginning toward that. It'll obviously get a whole lot better. We'll also have apps for BlackBerry and Android sometime this summer. And so just to make it easy, you know, just trying to make it easy for people.
Yeah, that's cool.
I gotta say, I really love the iPhone app, though. It keeps everything organized. I like how you have the airport diagrams right built in there. It's usually, if I'm spotting at DC, I like to have one earbud in, just listening to the. It's a great alternative to having a scanner.
Yeah, I was going to ask you where you plane spotted, but I guess that DCA was probably one, and you're within driving distance of, you know, two other major ones. So
yeah, here's the thing: I don't have a car, so DCA is my buddy, because that's very easy with mass transit.
Nice.
Yeah, but you know, Dave, I'm just absolutely fascinated by what you've done. And I, as I said earlier before the show started, I've been a fan for years. And I tell me, what in the world got you started making this whole thing come together?
A lot. It really started as kind of an accident. It's interesting. You know, when I was getting interested in getting my pilot's license, I was always kind of fascinated by aviation. I grew up in Philadelphia, and kind of like not that far from Philly.
Davidstown.
So not too far from Philly International, and I used to see the planes going down the river visual, and would ride my bike out to the airport and stuff like that. And I was kind of fascinated by it. But about 7 years ago, and this was after I had gotten interested in aviation communications again and then got my pilot's license, I just said, well, you know, it'd be kind of cool to really understand some of the procedures and learn more about the how things work, you know, with air traffic control, because I was working on my instrument rating. And I put a few scanners online at a friend's house, actually down near Boston, and was just streaming them. And I thought, well, you know, if I'm listening to it, why don't I share it with the rest of the world? And all of a sudden, this community kind of grew out of this. There were people who offered to do the same thing in other cities and other countries. And I said, wow, this is pretty cool. We'll start to build something a little bit bigger out of it. And my background's in internet technology. It was part of my background. And so I said, you know, this would really be pretty cool. Years ago, I used to listen to I think it was Brooklyn. It was maybe City University of New York, Brooklyn, SUNY Brooklyn, had JFK online. And they did it with, at the time, you know, Real Audio was kind of the real big name in streaming audio. And the whole thing's advanced since then. But they had like four streams, you know, the same, just JFK Tower. But they had like maybe no more than 10, certainly. They had a development version of the Real Audio server. And every day, you know, I used to be riveted to that thing. And you would have to, and this is kind of the early days of the internet, you'd have to basically, you know, get there. And it's like dialing a phone number that's busy all the time. You just keep connecting, try to get one of those 8 slots or 10 slots. Mm-hmm. And then you tried to stay connected all day, you know, hogging it. So I said, well, you know, somebody could certainly do this a lot better these days. And I had, you know, the means and the knowledge to do it. So it's really kind of a collision of an interest in aviation and an interest in communications. I've been a ham radio operator for, let's see, is that 1.0 Robs or? No, it's got to be more. Anyway,
I see he's going to be one of those kind of guests.
Yeah.
You just got an invite back. You know that, right?
Yeah. I'm probably a little bit older, but the collision of that and my ham radio hobby, which I've done for a very long time, I won't say exactly how long, it kind of came together, and I've got a lot of radio knowledge, so I sort of know how all this stuff works and what it takes to really set up a station so that you can get really good reception. And so I do this. I actually host a lot of, you know, many of the receivers, but the community that's rallied around this and has shown a great interest in it also helps by, you know, either hosting receivers for us or providing their own, you know, people at airports. I mean, there's a wide community of people that are involved with this, and it's because of all that help and because of all that interest and cooperation, and other people just love this.
Give us an insight of, imagine, say, O'Hare or mm-hmm. Philly or something. Where are the signals coming from? Is somebody have an antenna on top of their house near Philly? I mean, is this something David could get involved in and, you know, make a little extra cash or something? I don't know.
So it's people who generally, we try to locate people who are near airports, you know, within 5 or 10 miles, ideally. But, you know, you could be out at 15 or 20 miles as long as you have an outside antenna. It kind of ranges all over the place. Obviously, getting as close as you can to the transmitters. It's easy to pick up the airplanes because they're all flying at thousands of feet above ground. You can pick them up with pretty much any kind of receiver. But the ground stations are very challenging. You not only have to know where they are, and in the case of most major airports, they're generally there. You know, you'll see those towers kind of in the middle of the runways on the grass, and a lot of times, you know, those are associated with that airport. Not always. Sometimes it's en route control and things like that. But those are generally harder to pick up because they don't transmit with a lot of transmitter power. It varies with, you know, the facility and all that, but it makes it very challenging just because of the effects of terrain and relative line of sight and that kind of stuff. So that's the challenging part, and that's what makes it really important to strategically pick the receiver locations. And you don't always have a choice where they are. Sometimes you just have to do with, you have a volunteer who steps forward and he's out at 15 miles and you just try to make it work, you know, just through using better antennas and maybe a better receiver or that kind of stuff.
So I always thought that this was picked up, you know, from feeds from the airport. I didn't realize that this is actually picked up from the open airwaves by receivers and then pipe in through you, huh?
Yeah, there are some that are provided by airports. They're in the minority. Those are but generally they're separate receivers because, you know, you can't really get tapped into the audio stream directly. That's all, you know, private FAA circuits and stuff like that. So you have to have a receiver somewhere. But we do have some that are located. We have many that are located right at airports.
So is there ever the possibility of, you know, during some kind of a crisis or some kind of event, I'm thinking of a 9/11 kind of event, where the FAA may not want you broadcasting air traffic control? Is that a possibility?
Well, it's kind of interesting. I don't think it's a possibility. There's always the possibility, but there's never been any hint of an incident, you know, or anything like that.
Yeah.
In fact, I've been in touch with some FAA folks who were actually very interested in tuning in or getting, you know, making sure they sort of had a list of all the stations, which are right on the website. So it was kind of a curious conversation. But the guy who I had this conversation with was basically looking to be able to, you know, use this on a regular basis because it provided a capability for him and his staff down in DC that they don't have. So it was kind of interesting. So they use it extensively, I think, for just sort of, you know, listening into things and kind of keeping an eye on things where they can't always do that in real time. They can go back and listen to things. I mean, you can go directly to a facility and, you know, sit there and plug in, but remotely, they don't really have a system to sort of monitor all that. They can go back to the tapes if they need to review an accident, things like that. But it's pretty useful for them to actually be able to listen in some areas.
I specifically want to know how you got the receiver in Omsk, Russia. Did you have to go over there to do that?
No. So, you know, as I was mentioning earlier, many of the receivers are provided by volunteers who are just kind of really into what we're doing here. And Live ATC also deploys and fields a lot of these receivers. The way it works is you either get a volunteer or, you know, I sort of pick a location that we really want to cover and then just sort of go after it to find a location to put the equipment. And it really just consists of a PC, sound card, and a single receiver or a set of receivers, depending on how involved the airspace is, where the particular coverage is going to be. So in a lot of cases, and, you know, JFK is one of the more popular ones, only I think because of the international flavor and its sheer size and the activity there. But we've got that split up into many different receivers that towers sort of separate and different approach sectors at New York TRACON. And we try to keep things so that every channel that a listener might tune into doesn't have too many blocked communications where you might, if you have like a scanner scanning, say, 10 or 16 frequencies, you'll just sort of won't be able to follow anything. Now, we do have other locations that have a single receiver covering a number of frequencies, and those are places we either haven't quite divided out yet just due to resource issues, or doesn't really make sense to do it because there might be one really busy time for like an hour every day, and then the rest of it's just kind of quiet. So it's not really worth investing in splitting that one out.
Hey, Dave. One of the things that I've liked doing on Live ATC Net is tracking flights. Am I just sick that way, or is that something other people do? Like pick a flight and just follow it across the country.
No, there's people that do try to do that, and it's a lot of people that have, especially a relative traveling, they sort of feel like connected in some way if they can hear the pilots talking through the whole flight, you know. The flight tracking sites, there's some obviously great ones out there, FlightAware and so forth. People are kind of glued to those things these days because there's just so much information out there. But yeah, people do try to do it with the communications as well. It's kind of hard. We've actually had some people through all liveatc.net receivers, actually almost except for maybe one control sector, follow a flight all the way across the Atlantic because we have HF coverage. So all of the transoceanic communications is generally HF, you know, shortwave radio. So there's all that coverage in the middle there. And I think the only thing we didn't have is the UK coverage because it's kind of a, it's kind of outlawed there. So
yeah. Can you tell us about that? Cause I bet a lot of our listeners don't understand why this doesn't work as well over there in the UK.
Yeah. There's an issue there where, there's a law that kind of dates back to the early, you know, 40s and back in wartime where they tried to essentially legislate against, you know, people listening in on military communications. that law stayed on the books, you know, for years. And now, even in this day and age where there's so much other information, in fact, I've seen webcams that are pointed right on the flight path at Heathrow. They still outlaw this particular activity. There's something that they, you know, don't like about it. I've actually had direct communication with the government authorities over there, and it's just not something they're inclined to even be able to do. I mean, it's a major big deal to change this legislation, apparently, especially in a terrorism obsessed, you know, world now, or sensitive world, where people just suspect that anything that even seems remotely like a terrorist could use is something that ought to be avoided at all costs. And it's just kind of, it's pretty irrational, but it's the reality we live in.
Dave, are there any new things coming with liveatc.net that we should mention?
So we have, I know this is not a surprise to some of the more constant listeners and people who follow our tweets and Facebook postings and everything, but we will have apps for Android and BlackBerry and any other mobile platform that gains any kind of traction. And we'll have those sometime this summer. I can't give an exact date yet. Lots of new airports. We have a facelift underway for the website as well, just to kind of improve the usability and get a whole lot more content out there as well. Mm-hmm. That kind of will bring the novice listener in a little bit more, in a little more orderly fashion, where we can educate them a little bit on how this whole thing works and what some of the lingo is and all that sort of stuff. So that's in the works as well. So a lot of that stuff's going to hit this summer or fall, and it's going to be really great.
Sounds good. Sounds very exciting.
Just really quick, I mean, these apps that you have for the smartphones, I mean, these are no small technology venture. I mean, how in the world are you sort of funding the work to get this done?
You know, there's different revenue streams. The mobile platform itself is kind of a revenue stream that funds, you know, further development and also funds further development of the site itself. So so that's the way.
You accept donations at liveatc.net?
We do. So we accept donations, you know, the advertising income, and we've got mobile app income. So it's holding its own. Certainly welcome donations from anybody who thinks it's cool and really enjoys it. And there's people who get hours and hours and hours of enjoyment out of it. So
could we sponsor an airport, kind of like those things you see along the road where a town sponsors a piece of road? And, you know, we could sponsor Philly International. The Airplane Geeks are sponsoring Philly International, you know, or I don't know.
Absolutely. We do a lot of stuff like that. So absolutely.
Cool.
Dan ask a question. He's going to get upset.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right.
So Dave, one thing I said off here, like one reason I love about LiveATC, I love listening to Boston John. And for those who are not New Englanders, there's this air traffic controller at Logan who's just hilarious with the way he says airline names and stuff. But are there any other controllers out there anywhere in the world that just seem to have fun with the job?
Can I do my Boston John imitation first?
Absolutely.
JetBlue! That was terrible.
That's good.
Yeah, you know, there are. He's probably has the most notoriety. He's a really great guy. Actually, corresponded with him online, and it's just a super, super nice guy. But yeah, there are people who listen in, and they have favorite controllers in various places. And it's kind of amazing. I mean, it's almost like some of these guys are, and I don't think all of them know it, but they're like, you know, folk heroes for these guys. They sort of really look up to them, and it's literally a source of entertainment for them. So it's pretty interesting to sort of watch all this happen.
All right, Dave, we have a little thing that we do called word association, and we'll just do a quick round. What we do is each of us says a word or a phrase or something, and then you respond with just whatever pops into your head.
Okay.
Are you game?
I'm in.
Go ahead, David. Why don't you go first?
Okay, Dave. Favorite channel?
Boston Tower.
And why is that?
Just because it's, I guess, where I started the whole thing. And I live, you know, near the airspace. So I'm just sort of still wedded to it, surprisingly. But I'd like to hear what's going on close by.
Sentimental reasons, huh?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Rob, have you got one?
Aeropark Jorge Newberry.
That is...
I have no idea where that is. It's just number seven on your list.
It's an airport in South America, but I'm trying to remember what country that's...
I just realized I can click on it. Wait, I'll tell you. It's in... it's in Buenos Aires.
All right. Well, I got the
continent.
Buenos
Aires is not a country.
It's in Argentina.
In Argentina.
At least I got the continent right.
Yeah.
Dave, I actually know quite a bit about geography, interestingly enough, but I don't know all the airport names. One of the interesting things with this is every time a new airport comes in, especially outside the U.S. or even in the U.S., when you actually go to AirNav or wherever to look up the name of the airport, some of them are just like, oh, that's what that's really called.
Dave, how many of the airports you have on the site are outside of the U.S.? I mean, percentage-wise, do you know?
Percentage-wise, I don't know the exact number. We're probably around airport-wise.
Yeah.
It's probably a third or thereabouts, or maybe slightly less than a third.
But a good number.
Yeah, it's a good number, and it's actually one of the fastest-growing areas for us.
Cool.
Hey, Dave, I mean, do you have people from FAA ever talk to you about? I don't mean controllers necessarily, but more the management side say, wow, this is – pretty neat setup, or do they just never talk to you? Or I'm just curious.
Yeah, I mean, I've talked to some of the management at facilities, and they really think it's pretty cool because they use it in a lot of their safety seminars. In fact, I know a lot of the safety seminars. I go to a lot of them in New England, and it's actually right up there on a slide telling people, you know, go use this, go listen to the archives and the recordings, and go learn something about how things are really done in the airspace. And student pilots, it's used in a lot of flight schools as a resource for them. So yeah, I was talking earlier about one administrator from one particular department who felt that it was an extremely useful resource, and they used it all the time there for what they do.
Hmm. Oh, that's pretty wild. Well, I mean, I notice our local airport's not part of the LiveATC. .net coverage. So is that something we could talk about at some point? I mean, maybe we can figure out a way to make that work.
We can fix that. Where are you?
Chicago. Palwaukee, just north of O'Hare.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. In fact, somebody was asking about that the other day. So, yeah, absolutely. We can fix that.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Wow. Okay. Dan, I've stalled as long as I can, buddy.
I'm going to tap out of this one, actually.
Come on, Dan. You're a young guy with those neurons that are firing really fast. Come on, man.
You don't know him very well, do you?
You.
If you push him, he's going to say seat pitch.
Yeah, you know what? Screw it. Seat pitch. Go.
Pull up.
That's good.
Well.
All right.
I believe we're talking about two different types of pitch, sir.
I think we are.
All right, Dave, I've got one. This is a phrase. Funniest ATC transmission.
Funniest, wow.
Or crazy or unusual or anything like that. Anything that sort of sticks out as sort of a remarkable thing that you've heard on the airwaves.
There was a flight male pilot requesting a shortcut from a female controller. Now, this is, if you ever listen to, especially en route control, they're always, you know, everybody's always trying to get shortcuts because they're always late and, you know, they're pressured for, you know, not burning more fuel than they have to. So he's basically asking her if he can get a shortcut, and she says, you know, on request, which is kind of the standard phraseology.
Okay.
And he says to her in the next transmission, isn't that a new hairdo? It looks really nice. And she goes, American, I don't know if it was American, but, you know, American 123 cleared direct, you know, and she gave him a shortcut way down the road. You know, this is late at night anyway, and things are generally more free, you know, on certain routes. But I thought that was pretty cool. That was probably the biggest one that made me chuckle, but there's so many of them. It's insane.
Yeah, I bet.
Dave, I was listening Christmas Eve, listening to Philly Departure, and off in the distance, everybody heard it. You heard Merry Christmas. And that's all you heard. That was great.
Well, it's funny, you know, they have to keep it interesting. There's a lot of folks, and there's a lot of controllers and pilots who know how to lighten up a little bit, and then there's some that are just, you know, it's all business, it's all rigid.
Sure, like anything, I guess.
But it's like anything else, and you know, there's no harm with a lot of this stuff. And at some point, it's so, you know, somebody's got to break the monotony up a little bit sometimes. I mean, you wouldn't want to turn it into a circus, but sometimes yeah, sure. It brightens everybody's day. And ultimately, I think that just makes everybody feel better and probably do better in their jobs and everything. So.
Great. Dave, tell our listeners where people can find you online. You're on Twitter, right?
Yep. LiveATC on Twitter. We are also facebook.com/liveATC. And of course, there's other ways to contact me at liveATC.net.
Fantastic. Thanks again for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Dave.
Hey, that was fun, Dave.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australian News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Would the prisoner please rise? Mr. McHaren, you have committed crimes of a particularly heinous and venal nature, and this court finds you extremely naughty. And we hereby sentence... What's that noise at the door? Bailiff, go and... Bailiff, go and check what's going on.
Let me in. I'm a new media superstar. Let me in. I demand to be heard. Look, over there. It's Helen Clark. Look, everybody.
Quick, no!
Quick, Grant. Quick, Grant. They're distracted. Quick, come with me, quick.
Bailiff, stop them. They're getting away. They're getting away. Release the sheep.
A quick reprogramming session here, Grant, while we're out here on the street. Your favourite opera singer?
Oh, Dame Kiri DeCarnowa, cuz.
No, try again.
Dame Kiri DeCarnowa.
No, it's Nellie Melba. Okay, next. Favourite airline?
In New Zealand.
Oh, dear.
Ow.
No, starts with Q,
What? Quaint Ass?
There you go. Well, that's a start. And,
Quaint Ass is definitely not my favourite airline.
Well, look here's one that'll definitely get through to you, if nothing else will. What's your favourite beer?
Oh, Lion Nathan, cuz.
Oh, dear. I see we have a lot of work to do. Okay, well, look, here's a copy of Australian Aviation that I've got rolled up in my back pocket here. Have a read of this and see if you can practice your accent while you're at it. Virgin Blue, set for an identity change.
Oh, Virgin Blue? Yeah, they're my favourite Wait, isn't it Air New Zealand? I can't... What? No, Virgin Blue's my favourite airline.
Well, there you go. See, it's working already.
Yeah, I like Virgin Blue. Oh, they're going to change the name. Mm. Hey, apparently here they're going to change the name, get new aircraft, and... I'm feeling better already, man. Thank you. You saved me from an accent that I really couldn't do.
Right, we haven't got too much time before the sheep squad catches up with us, so read this one quickly, Grant.
But we covered all this ages ago, mate, back in episode 33 when we were chatting with Ben Sandilands. We spoke about everything going on, about the potential for a name change, chance of getting either an Airbus A330 or 767 for its wide body, bringing everything together, you know, all this kind of stuff. We've already talked about all this.
Well, of course, in fairness to Dan, that was all rumour-file stuff at the time, but now John Borghetti has put the plan in motion. He's presented a new business plan for the airline to its board during the week, and amongst other things, they're planning to introduce business class possible wide-body aircraft on short-haul services, something they do need, Grant, because they've been running 737s and Embraer E-Jets on their shorter routes, and I can tell you from a recent trip that I made with them across to Perth, you know, that aircraft was full, and there's obviously the demand for larger aircraft to operate on some of their longer routes.
Oh, yeah, definitely, and plus the whole constraint of caps and Sydney and so on. I mean, over here, we can't just schedule more aircraft and hope that we can squeeze them in, like seems to happen over in the States. We actually cannot schedule a flight unless we have a slot. And with slot restraints at Sydney Airport, you have to upgrade to a bigger aircraft to be able to handle the load. Otherwise, you're just going to be turning people away. So, yeah, the big question is going to be, is it going to be an A330 or a 767? I mean, as we said in that episode, the rumour is that Boeing's practically going to give them away, the 767s, just to keep them from getting Airbuses. So it's really interesting to see what happens. It's still not 100% confirmed yet. Things are happening. He has presented the business plan mostly for business class, but still not 100% sure what kind of aircraft they're going to go for and what they're doing about the name. They want to get common branding across Virgin Blue, V Australia and Pacific Blue, but the big question is, will it be under the V Australia name, or will Virgin and Sir Richard Branson finally have been able to convince Singapore Airlines to allow another international carrier called Virgin, because that's the blocker. Singapore Airlines have got veto on that. So maybe Singapore Airlines have changed their mind, or more likely, maybe they've managed to finally find something that will make Singapore Airlines be willing to make that change.
Well, the previous CEO, Brett Godfrey, had already been making moves in that direction. And really, I mean, Singapore Airlines, although they've never made any secret of the fact that they would like to operate trans-Pacific routes from Australia, and I think this plays into it, doesn't it, Grant? That's never going to happen, and maybe they should just be a tad more realistic about it. And to be able to brand it as something like Virgin Australia, I personally think that would fit in better with their brand. I mean, you've got Virgin Atlantic, Virgin America, yep. So to have Virgin Australia or Virgin Pacific or something like that, yep. To me would be a much better brand for them, and would be something well worth pursuing. On the subject of different aircraft types, well, of course, Borghetti has come from Qantas, where they operate a large and diverse fleet, and he was quite instrumental, I think, in introducing a large fleet of Airbus aircraft into the Qantas fleet, and they had previously been solely Boeing customers, so it's not something that he doesn't have any experience in doing, and wouldn't be something that he would hesitate doing if the price was right.
Definitely. He has got a lot of experience with A330. He can do a very objective comparison between the Airbus and the 767. It's going to be very interesting to see where that one goes. One other thing about Singapore wanting the Pacific market, they definitely wanted in on the Pacific market, but now that Via Australia and Delta are in the market, prices are tumbling, margins are much reduced. Suddenly that market doesn't look so cool for Singapore, I don't think. They may not really want to get into it anymore.
Yeah, well, that's very true too. And of course, Singapore Airlines at one stage was the richest airline on the face of the planet. I don't think that's the case these days.
And, no, the GFC clobbered a lot of airlines, and Singapore lost a lot of its premium market that it used to have a major margin on.
Yeah, which puts them in the same boat as every other airline in the world. Premium travel is just falling away and being replaced by premium economy, you know, business class, isn't it? It's dying everywhere, so I'm sure they're no exception to that rule.
But the Singapore Girl and the Emirates are still the two airlines to fly if you want that top quality. All the reports indicate that it's still Singapore Girl or Emirates is the way to go if you want a bit of quality, even in just premium economy, let alone business or first. Qantas just can't really compete on that. They've got a first-class product, and it is very good. It's wonderful, but it's very hard to compete against those two.
And of course, while we're talking about Singapore Airlines, Grant, there's also been a bit of a rumour floating around that they might be coming to some sort of alliance with Virgin Blue, a rumour which has been quashed by Singapore Airlines. They've really poured cold water on it, according to this article by our favourite journalist, Steve Creedy, Grant.
Yeah, well, you never know. I mean, with the chance that they're going to rebadge, if they can get Virgin, maybe Singapore are just trying to deflect everyone, and it really is happening. You know, it's quite often the case that the more someone strenuously denies it, the more likely it may actually be happening.
Yeah, sounds like politics in Australia lately.
Yes, definitely.
Okay, and just some sad news before we make our quick getaway here, Grant. A number of Australians have been lost this week in Africa in an airplane crash, and in fact, almost the entire board of management of one of our mining companies.
That's right. It was actually the entire board and the CEO, as well as a local billionaire mining magnate. They and some other people were on a CASA 212 that was flying in Cameroon. It looks like it may have had a collision with terrain while flying in cloud. Quite similar, actually, in scenario to the aircraft that crashed up near Kokoda in Papua New Guinea. The tragedy here is that they were all flying on the one aircraft. Now, usually most companies have a "you shall not do this" kind of clause. Unfortunately, they were all on the one aircraft. It crashed, and they've actually had to suspend the sale of shares of Sundancer on the market, and there's rumours that it could actually kill the company.
Interesting, too, that it was a CASA 212, Grant, and I've heard a lot of comment recently about that aircraft since this news came to light, calling into question the reliability of the CASA 212. Now, of course, as anyone who's listened to PCDU episode 30, where we talked to the Antarctic crew, they actually operate a couple of those aircraft down there in the Antarctic, so they can't be that bad an aircraft.
No, well, they fly them long distance from Tasmania all the way down south to Antarctica with ferry tanks, big bladders installed in them. So, yeah, operating them in Antarctica, which is one of the most inhospitable parts of the world, you'd want to have a reliable aircraft. So it may be that it's not so much the CASA 212 as it was particularly the ones being maintained over there in Africa. Who knows? But we're a little way away from the reports yet. They're still trying to blaze a trail through the jungle to get to the wreck.
Yep, and we'll keep you up to date on how that's going, folks. And we certainly hope that they can find out some sort of cause to that crash.
They did say that when they got to the crash scene via helicopter, I do remember seeing mention somewhere that flight data recorder or cockpit recorder had been retrieved. That did surprise me. I wasn't sure that they had them. But who knows? It could be journalistic error, or they really did have it and have retrieved it.
Well, Grant, time's running short. I don't know. That probably just about wraps it up. Was there anything else that you saw there that took you fancy?
Look at this. Look at this. Virgin Blue switched over to a new reservation systems and it crashed. I wonder if they use an IBM in Auckland with a data center, just like in New Zealand.
Oh, my goodness. It's a relapse. It's a relapse. So we're going to have to...
What's up,
guys? Quick, they're over there. Get them.
Oh, no, they're after us, Grant. Quick, into the boat.
We're okay, bro. Let's
quick,
go.
Quick, down to the harbour. Quick, down to Auckland Harbour. Quick, back in the Tupperware container. Let's go, quick.
But I want my chips.
You can have your chips on the boat.
Oh, okay. Oh, is the boat beached as?
Not for long. We're out of here.
God loves New Zealand. He gave us boiling mud.
No!
I love the part about the sheep.
I think we need to have a fund for them to connect with my wife. I think they are definitely patient material.
You think she could help them?
Oh,
does your wife
probably
do Skype
not.
Therapy
she probably
sessions?
Have a lot of fun trying.
Skype therapy sessions.
Man.
Hey, Rob, if I ever have a personal crisis because I know you, will your wife treat me for free?
It depends on whether I'm the crisis or not.
If Rob is the cause, you definitely will be treated for free.
All right, David, have you got This Week in Aviation for us?
Welcome to This Week in Aviation, Volume 2, Episode 19, June 27th through July 3rd. June 28th, 1927, the Bird of Paradise, a Fokker C-2 flown by United States Army Corps Lieutenants Lester Maitland and Albert Hagenberger, arrive on the island of Hawaii. The 2,407-mile, 3,873-kilometer flight was made even more harrowing by the fact that halfway through the flight, the crew lost their radio direction finder. The flight over the Eastern Pacific lasted 25 hours and 50 minutes. It was the first flight from the continental U.S. to the Hawaiian Islands. June 29th, 1927. 2 days after one Fokker flew the Pacific, another Fokker flew the Atlantic. Admiral Richard E. Byrd, with co-pilot Bernt Bakken and two others, fly the first transatlantic airmail, again in a Fokker C-2 named America. That's two-thirds of the total U.S. Army Air Corps Fokker C-2s that ever occurred that the Army had bought. They took off using a ramp a la Hot Wheels style to get speed for their takeoff with a full fuel load. The flight began at Roosevelt Field in the middle of the mall. Okay, a small joke for our New York listeners. don't know that Roosevelt Field was an airfield before it was a mall. After 40 hours of almost reportedly flying into the Eiffel Tower, the crew ditched the aircraft off the coast of Normandy. The beach they crashed at would become even more famous later when other Americans landed there on June 6, 1944. The beach would forever be known as Omaha. On June 29, 1932, the first successful hookup of a Curtiss F-9C Sparrowhawk with the USS Akron. The F-9C was a class of fighters known as parasites. The U.S. Navy dirigibles Akron and her sister Macon each had a hangar deck with as many as four aircraft each. U.S. Navy Lieutenant Daniel Harrington was the first to make the hookup, and eventually the Sparrowhawks would lose their landing gear, only having them reattached at the end of a deployment. The next one, I fell in love with this story earlier today. July 1st, 1935. Brothers Fred and Al Keyes finally land. To bring their attention to their struggling Meridian Airport, the brothers set out to break the then endurance record of 23 days. Using their Curtiss Robin J-1 named the Old Miss, the brothers took off on June 4th and proceeded to orbit around the city and the airfield of Meridian, Mississippi for 635 hours and 34 minutes, totaling a little over 27 days. Regularly, another Curtiss Robin would take off and join up with the Old Miss and drop a line down with food, water, and supplies. Fred had built a catwalk out to the engine so he could service it in flight.
Wow.
The brothers, with the help of mechanic A.D. Hunter, developed a refueling system where fuel would only transfer when the hose was inserted into a receptacle. The Hunter valve is still used today on all aircraft that refuel in the air. The flight traveled 52,320 miles and used over 6,000 gallons of gas, mostly transferred in flight. To quote Dan, useless fact. The current user of the Hunter valve, the KC-135 tanker, can transfer over 1,200 pounds of fuel in 1 minute. The 6,000 gallons of fuel used by the Old Miss equals 36,000 pounds of fuel.
So the 135 can transfer the total amount of Ole Miss fuel in less than 30 minutes.
Wow.
Both brothers would go on to receive the Dosung's Flying Cross in flying bombers in World War II in the Pacific. And Dan, the Ole Miss hangs from the ceiling at the NASM on the Mall.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. A replica Vimy, Vickers Vimy, piloted by the late Steve Fawcett with co-pilot Mark Reboltz, recreates the flight of Alcott and Brown. The flight takes off on July 2, 2005 from St. John, Newfoundland, Canada, and ends in Clifton, Ireland, 18 hours later. The flight was flown completely in IFR. The replica Vimy NX-71MY was built in 1994, and after several reenactments, was retired to a museum late last year. On a side note, I'm sure this ruined some putts, but Fawcett landed the Vimy in the middle of the 8th fairway at Canmara Golf Course. I really wonder if he shouted four first. And in other news, some woman got lost over some island in some ocean on July 2nd, 1937. I guess it was sort of important because Hilary Swank recently made a movie about it.
Yeah.
Dan, you know what that is?
Amelia Earhart.
That's right. And since I covered it last year, I wasn't going to cover it this year, per your request.
It was never per my request. It was more of an inquiry. I cannot say inquiry today. Wow.
First flights that occurred during the week of June 27th to July 3rd. The Lockheed L-12 Electra Jr., June 27th, 1936. The Grumman F-6F Hellcat, June 28, 1942. The Bell 407 helicopter, June 29, 1995. The Lockheed C-5A Galaxy, June 30, 1968. And lastly, the reason why soon we all want to go to Oshkosh, the Douglas DC-1, predecessor of the DC-3, July 1, 1933. And that's the way it was, June 27 through July 3rd.
Boy, that endurance flight, that was new to me. I hadn't heard about that.
Can you imagine oiling a radial at 2,000 feet? Hey, if you go out to Wikipedia and look up Fred and Al Keyes, or the Flying Keyes as they were known, there's a picture of Al out on the front of the airplane servicing the engine.
Wow, got to check that out. All right, how about on to some listener mail? Let's see, we had a tweet from the Aviator Man who asked us a question. He said, "Airplane Geeks, any recommendations on preferred executive jets or turboprops that go into fields 3,000 feet and under?" This sounds like a question for Rob.
Rob.
Well, preferred executive jets that go into fields 3,000 feet and under are limited. CJ, let's see. I'm going to do this off the top of my head. I'm sure I'll get yelled at by one of the manufacturers I don't think about. The Phenom would do it. The Embraer. The CJs would do it. The Cessna. Let's see, Learjet's not a good idea. Let's see, Hawker, no, I wouldn't take a Hawker into a 3,000-foot strip. Gulfstream, no, I don't think so.
No, there goes my G4.
Yeah, I think we're kind of running short of airplanes here. Bombardiers.
No, he did say turboprops, too.
Oh, did he say turboprops? Well, I didn't hear
executive jets or turboprops.
Oh, I'm sorry. I only heard executive jets.
So you were talking about the jets. Turboprops.
Yeah, and turboprops, there aren't that many, actually. I mean, there's the King Air, which, of course, is still made. That would do 3,000 feet pretty easily. Other turboprops, there are single-engine turboprops.
How about the Pilatus?
Pilatus, right. Pilatus PC-12 would be a great choice for a 3,000-foot strip. In fact, Pilatus is like flying in an SUV. But then I don't know what kind of style these executives expect to be kept in. So those are a few, though.
Yeah, that's good. That's more than a few. That's a lot. Do you have any short runway stories from your illustrious past?
None that I want to share at this time because the FAA never gets.
All right, good. And we got a voicemail from Jeff.
Hi, Geeks. This is Jeff. I am listening to the most recent ep, and I'm not quite through it completely yet, but before you guys record on Sunday, I just wanted to chime in with a thought about the 737-600 that you just commented on briefly in your last episode and how it was being broken up for parts. And I agree with all the points that you made where this, you know, it's just a shorter version and thus generally don't fare as well. And you know, just, it's a little bit of a niche plan just due to the size. But it was also my understanding that, the primary kind of reason that this plane was being broken up is just that the airline that had it at the time, I think it was Midwest Airlines out of Egypt, used a series of overweight landings, which caused some structural issues with the plane, and that's more or less what was the reason behind it being broken up. So just want to get some of your thoughts on that. Love your show, and have a great day. Bye.
And thanks to Jeff for that. That's interesting. I guess we didn't know that that was the reason behind that parting out of that 737.
Dan,
I was not aware of that actually.
Oh.
Well, hopefully when they're parting this thing out, that they're sticking with the parts that are still flightworthy.
That aren't structurally unsound.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
you know, David, when you think about it, really, when a guy goes to a bar to try to meet ladies, like Dan may occasionally, and he says, "Hey, baby, did you know I'm a supply chain miner?" I mean, what kind of answers do we expect out of the guy, right? I mean,
come back to my apartment and let me show you my Excel spreadsheets.
Yeah, you want to see some Oh, yeah. Oh, man. Hot, baby.
Well, I mean, if I was an operations management major, I'd be like, "Hey, baby, I'm a Six Sigma black belt."
Yeah, that'll turn him on. All right, we also got an email from Shrinan, who sent in a really great email. I covered a number of different topics. He mentions he's an airplane enthusiast from India. He's a pilot for a major international airline, and he comments that he is a big fan of the podcast. He says he even started recognizing each of the voices. Shrinan says, "I know Rob's 90. David can't pronounce. Max is the one who never gets asked what blog he's on, and Dan is approaching puberty."
And he says, "I like this guy."
He says, "Kidding, yeah, I think you guys are great."
It's pretty smart for an airline pilot.
Yeah, he sure
Ooh.
Is.
Oh.
Ooh, okay.
Oh, you went there. Oh, my God.
He has to know that I was one, so I can say that kind of stuff.
Shrinan brings up a couple of issues. Maybe we can touch on a few of them on in-flight entertainment systems. He says that the level of IFEs on Asian carriers in general, like Singapore Airlines, Cathay Pacific, Jet Airways, Kingfisher, and the like, is superb as compared to American and certainly European carriers. Maybe partly because air travel is not as pedestrian yet in these parts, but it remains a huge part of the traveling experience and something that the airlines just can't afford to skimp on here.
He's excluding Tiger Airways, I'm assuming, right?
You noticed that, huh?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I think as LCCs grow, perhaps we'll see some changes. But of American carriers, I'm actually looking forward to this time tomorrow. I'll be on final approach, hopefully. But I'll be on my first flight with Virgin America. And supposedly, domestically, they have one of the best in-flight entertainment systems around. So I'm hoping to get a test ride.
Yeah.
So, Dan, where are you going?
I am going, Virgin this past week started a service to Toronto, but their big launch party is actually on Tuesday. So tomorrow I'm flying to San Francisco, flying to Toronto on Tuesday, going to meet with Courtney, hopefully. And then since full disclosure, Virgin is comping everything to save money, I am flying back to D.C. Via San Francisco. So
cool.
Great I'll trip. Be spending a lot of time on planes in the next 3 days.
All right. Well, we'll expect a full report.
Of course.
Shrinan goes on and mentioned our discussion back in episode 86 with Phil Derner from NYC Aviation. This is where we were talking about spotting and, in particular, the spotters that were arrested in India. But Shrinan is pointing out that, you know, you got to sort of think of it in the context of the time and place. And he's recalling the circumstances that occurred in November 2008 with the terrorist attack on Bombay, which of course was an awful experience, and residual, maybe not even residual, but some sensitivity to things such as people standing around with cameras photographing aircraft, and that really is something that should be considered when you look at that experience that those I think it was two spotters went through there in India. So good, that was a good, great comment, I thought.
Isn't it? Is it Mumbai now, I think?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. No, but I agree.
Wait a minute. Max is dating himself? That's Rob's job, Max. Knock that off.
All right, I'll stop.
No, I mean, that makes sense. I mean, think of it like here post 9/11, like the months after. I mean, everyone was just
scared
/ freaked out.
Yeah, sure. So it's quite
still are.
Yes. Mm. And I'm sure that, you know, the same is true in India as well. Also, another topic he brings up, flight training. And he mentioned that he was fortunate enough to be in a program like that, where they took them from a 152 all the way to a Lear 45 and now into a 777. And in return for receiving that education, there's a commitment for 7 years of work for them, for that airline. And he mentions, you know, this is a win-win for both the airline, who gets a well-trained crew, and also has a committed staff, and it's also good for the pilots. So there's his example or his experience with training provided by his employer. And finally, Sridhan says that he's going to be coming to Oshkosh this year, fulfilling one of his longtime wishes. He's going to be there for the whole week, which is really, really great, really exciting. And he's looking forward to seeing the DC-3s in formation.
Well, he should drop me and Mr. Mark a line, of course, since we'll be there in attendance. So,
well, yes.
So it's great meeting listeners.
That's right. In fact, I already sent him an email after I saw that listener mail, and when I saw that he was going to be up there, and invited him to join us for our airplane geek out, or whatever we're calling it, during the week of Oshkosh there. And he's already said he's ready. So
great. Now, you set a time awesome. And a date, right, for that?
Yeah, actually, we just got that the other day. It's going to be the Tuesday afternoon of the Oshkosh Air Show, which is, don't quote me on the date because I don't have it in front of me, but it's the Tuesday of show week, 4 o'clock at one of the forums there, and it'll be under the Jetwine name. And hopefully, in fact, John Ostrower mentioned, is that what is it?
July 27th.
July 27th. Thank you so much, David. And who knows, John Ostrower is going to help. Dan Webbage said he, of course, will be there to help out.
I'm not sure how much helping I'll be doing. It'll be more like a supervisory role.
Well, I understand that. Yeah.
That's great.
Sure. And who knows?
Rob, I'll come out and help.
Maybe David will even show up. We'll find something cool to do,
or maybe Max.
Well, you never know. Okay, we'd really like to thank our guest this episode. That's Dave Pascoe from liveatc.net. You know, even if you've never listened to air traffic control before, it's worth it. Just give it a shot. Go over to liveatc.net. Just, you know, dial up your local airport or any random airport and just start listening. It's actually pretty fascinating.
It's very soothing as well. It's like a waterfall cascading around your eardrums.
Cascading?
That's pretty nerdy.
I'm sorry.
And occasionally they talk about rainbows and unicorns.
Thanks also to Steve Fisher and Grant McCarron from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast for the Australia Desk report. So let's do the plugs. David, where can people find you online?
I can be found at jetwine.com.
You know, we don't have to do this.
And Dan Webbage at Twitter.
And Rob, where can people find you?
Well, let's see. 30,000feet.com. What just flew by? And on Twitter, I'm at Dan Webbage.
Excellent. And Mr. Webb, how about you?
Well, all the other blogs have been spoken about, so I'm at thingsinthesky.com, and just to cover the two Twitter names, because they were, you know, I was done twice, DM Vanderhoof, and when I'm really bored, I tweet at Jetwine.
All right, that's great.
And Max?
What's left? I don't know what's left.
Max, where can people find you on the...
On Twitter.
There's Twitter at, you could do Miller22.
Miller22 on Twitter, that's right. Our illustrious creator. But you can find Airplane Geeks on Twitter also at Airplane Geeks, or you can send us email. That would be to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. You can also visit our fan page on Facebook. What we really enjoy, though, is getting your voicemail. So please give us a call and leave us a message.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
And as I said last week...
she worked this week.
I know.
Yes. And the main reason we like the voicemails is because just Google Voice just thinks of transcripts sometimes, so we get to laugh.
Sometimes we get to laugh quite a lot. All right, join us again next time as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. Let's just rock this.
All right, Dave, we want to thank you for joining us on this episode.
Thanks for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
So, can I ask him one question before he goes?
Yeah, well, I had a question, what, too.
Yeah, let's not kick him out yet.
Well, everybody's got a question. Okay.
I'm ducking.
Don't kick Dave out. Don't kick Dave out.
What happened to word association, by the way?
Oh, I forgot word association. All right, we'll do that first. But we'll do that next. Rob, first you have to unmute, Rob. All right, well, Rob maybe is taking a potty break, so meanwhile.
No, oh, you know what? I had my mic muted. I'm sorry. Here I'm talking and I'm saying, what, you didn't hear that the first time?
didn't you hear us say, Rob, unmute your mic?
No, I didn't hear that part. Okay.
All right, Dan, have you got a word for Dave?
No, that's not a word.
I don't think that counts as a word, Dan.
I've been trying to think for a few minutes.
Is it so hard, Boy Wonder?
It is. It is.
You can, it's kind of like a finals week, isn't it? Stunned.
Yeah. I just hope I'm not going to have nightmares about this tonight.
What's a good name? What's a good name for a judge?
Judge Awesome Superior.
Judge Mental.
Oh. Judge Bigoth, now in court in session. All rise for Judge Bigoth.
All right, so we'll start with the gavel. Grant, they're distracted. Quick, come with me, quick.
Hey, cuz. Okay.
Oh, my goodness. Quick, we're getting away.
I'm so confused. We're out of order.
Okay, we're back.
Okay. And so that's how I made my first $20 million. And if any of you have questions about that, remember, it's rob@jetwine.com.